Good morning.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot.
I guess I just want to kind of first of all start off by saying thank you to you, actually, to all of you. I think a while ago I said, I did a preach on, I was glad when they said unto me, let us come into the house of the Lord. And I really sort of feel that today. I feel like we're all under one spirit, under one anointing. And it is a privilege because it's an opportunity to take sanctuary, to take refuge. And that's not always something that people can have. So thank you all for being faithful in that. If I just thought I'll put out there before I start. Right. So we're going to start off by just, you know, looking at Ruth 2. I hope I do it as much justice as Dave has just basically announced, but I will definitely do my best, if nothing else. But before we do, I just wanted to sort of ask the question, really. Who out of all of us here likes a good story? Yes, we love good stories, don't we? I love a good story. And the Bible, obviously, is just full of them. It's full of all of these stories. And, you know, right now we're looking at one of those stories. We're looking at a story in Ruth. But sometimes when I think about the stories in the Bible and I think about the way I am as a person when I sort of read books and stuff, I always have this temptation when I start the book to kind of want to go to the end and kind of see what happens at the end, right? Instead of, you know, don't know what's coming next, you know, just want to kind of see what's happening at the end. I'm sure I'm the only one here that does that, you know. Everybody else sort of goes through, you know, that's very good, faithful people. But I tend to just always want to go to the end to see what's happened. So I'm kind of hoping that with the Ruth story, aside from those of you who have actually already read the book, that we haven't been tempted to kind of go towards the end, because that might ruin my middle bit that I'm trying I'm trying to get across right now. But yeah, let me basically ask another question and just say, from the Bible, what are some of those favorite stories? Think about some of the great characters that we have in the Bible. If I was asked you guys to kind of come up with a couple of those, whose story would we be thinking of? Let me just...
Job.
Who?
Job.
Oh, we did a series on that one. That's good. Job?
Solomon.
Solomon, yes. Wise King. Esther. Yes, indeed.
Joseph.
Joseph, absolutely. Great story.
Wonderful.
The woman at the well. Yeah. There's a lot of sort of notable characters in the Bible, right? A lot of stories that depict sort of their life and all of that. And I think I don't have a clicker. I only have I have an assistant. I was trying to do a... What's it called again? A word cloud, you know, and this is my first attempt at doing a word cloud. I think I did okay. But yeah, I just put up some names in there. So there's, as you know, someone mentioned Joseph, put Joseph on there. Gideon, that's a great story. I like Gideon's story. Samuel, Elijah, David, there's just so many, right? The Bible's just full of them, so many great stories. So I'm going to start looking at a specific passage before I come into our current story. So I was going to look at something that Dave mentioned when he was doing his preach. So Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 to 6. Oh, look at that. She's wonderful. Matthew 1, verses 1 to 6 is reading out the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And it basically says, this is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. I knew I was missing something. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Aminadab. Aminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. whose mother was Rahab, Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. And when I read through that, you'll be glad to know we're not going to read the whole genealogy of Jesus. But when I read through that, one of the things that kind of came to mind to me was, you know, this is the sort of beginning of Matthew's story, as it were, right? And if I look at, like, John 1 starts off saying, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And, you know, that sounds, you know, very sort of poetic, you know? And then you talk about Mark, and he's starting off with, you know, the birth of Christ and, you know, Bethlehem and all the rest of it. And then Matthew starts his book, and he starts just reading a whole bunch of names. It just seems a bit weird. Why would Matthew start his own book, or choose to start his own book, by reading a bunch of names? And so if we go back to basically what we're talking about in terms of characters, I think that's part of the reason, right? So there's some very notable sort of characters in that list, right? In there we have Abraham, who founded the nation, and you had Isaac, you had Jacob, and then obviously you had David, who was the renowned king of the nation of the Hebrews. So I decided, well, you know what? I did it the first time, it looked all right. I'll do another one. How about that? I did another word cloud. Do you know there's something missing in my word cloud?
I don't know if you've caught on to it. What do you think is missing?
Speak up. Don't be scared.
Ruth, yeah, Ruth is missing. Who else is missing? Do you know?
Tamar's missing, yeah. So I basically left all the ladies.
I left all the ladies from that list. And I did it
sort of in intentionally, right?
Because it is not normal when you're going through a genealogy to actually mention the ladies in the old days. When they go through the genealogy, they'll be mentioning the men, right? So they'll say, oh, your granddad was this, or your great-granddad was this, you know, because the men are the ones that were the notable characters. So it actually was unusual for women to be actually included. So Matthew started his book by mentioning these names. In those days, that would be fine, because basically you're trying to basically put validity to your claim. So it's almost like when you're like a king, right? You would want to say, oh, I'm the son of that king, that was the son of that king, that was the son of that king, to give validity to yourself. So that was what Matthew was trying to do, but it was weird because he kept mentioning these ladies, right? Ladies are not normally part of the genealogy, and why is he mentioning the ladies? But interestingly, he didn't mention all the ladies, so he didn't go for every single one of them, this is their wife, for every single one of them, this is their wife. He only mentioned some notable ladies. So there must be more to those particular stories that made them valuable to that list. And when I was thinking about that, I was kind of thinking a little bit about, like, when we, if the Americans, like, really love their presidents, right? So when they do history in America, they all learn sort of, you know, who are the presidents and, you know, that have come in. And, you know, I can't remember which one they're on now, 52nd or 55th or whatever it was, president that they currently have. But when they mention their presidents, obviously they're not all kind of built the same, right? You're going to have some presidents that did a lot. And then you're going to have some presidents that maybe, you know, they didn't do so much. Or maybe if it was possible to skip one or skip two, you might want to skip one or two of those because they didn't really do much. And that's kind of how it feels sometimes when we go through some of these Bible stories. You're kind of looking for the heroes. You're looking for the celebrities. You're looking for the ones that kind of stand out, right? And everything else. So let's actually now sort of read through into our story. So let's actually read Ruth chapter 2. It's 23 verses, so
a lot of slides.
So Ruth chapter 2 starts with this, and it says, now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields to pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out, entered the field, and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseers of his harvest, "Who does that young woman belong to?" The overseers replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I have been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you do not know. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread, and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roast grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. And she got up to glean. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to the men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead," she added. "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth, the Moabite, said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Okay, that was long. But I think it's important to kind of be able to give context to the story, right? Because here we're looking at Ruth's story, and as Dave kind of covered last week, this is, you know, two women that are coming from, you know, pretty harsh times, right? They've come under quite a, you know, come through quite a lot. So Ruth obviously in the last chapter had this option where she could have not
gone with Naomi to Bethlehem, right? Not gone to a foreign country, but gone back to her family. But there was something about Ruth that just made it impossible for her to almost break the promise that Naomi was trying to allow her to break, really. She just felt something within her that covenant was so strong, right? That she felt she had to keep that promise. She had to stay with Naomi. But as we all know, sometimes making a promise and keeping that promise are not always the same, right? It's not always as easy as we would like it to be. So when I was reading through the story, I kind of came across that weird word, gleaning. And then I sort of wanted to find out, you know, what does that actually kind of mean, right? And, you know, I went to our trusty friend Google. Don't tell Eliana, because I always say, don't go to Google. Do your own research. Find out these things for yourself. Close your ears, Eliana. Gleaning, according to Google anyway, gleaning is an act of collecting leftover crops from farmers' fields after they've been commercially harvested, or on fields where it's basically not economically profitable to harvest. So in Hebrew law, is legally enforced as an entitlement of the poor to be able to kind of glean after the harvesters. So I had a little picture here. Oof. I don't know if you can see that very well. But it's of a lady gleaning on a farm. And I have another picture on the right-hand side, which is kind of like the modern equivalent of gleaning, basically, which is basically getting some food out of the bin. And that's really what it was. So just wanted to make it quite clear that Ruth had not just fallen on hard times. She was at the bottom of the barrel. And so if we look at her story, basically we're talking about someone who was a woman. And as I said previously, in these times anyway, women were not like the pinnacles of society, right? They were needed, obviously, and they had a place in society, but mainly the entire economy of society in those days was run by men. And because wealth was acquired mostly by physical labor, women were always sort of at a disadvantage. And so Ruth has this thing where she's made this promise to stay with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law is very old, so her mother-in-law can't provide for them. So she turns to this as the only way to make sure that she can provide for her and her mother-in-law. The other thing I wanted to emphasize on there was, it wasn't, nowadays, basically the equivalent would be going into like Tesco's bins, and because it was commercial farming, right? So these were not sort of subsistence farms, they were sort of big commercial farms. So, but obviously Tesco's, you know, huge, so it's not really the same. More like maybe Londis or something like that, so one of those kind of smaller places, because they will, you know, they won't have as much. If you go to Tesco, they'll probably stop you from getting their bin because there's so much stuff in there. But the other thing as well, like I said, was she was a widow, right? And so not only was she a woman, which put her at a disadvantage, she was also a widow. So she had no husband to look after her. She had no children either to actually say, okay, I have hope that I can have some boys, and you know, when they get older, they can maybe look after us. So she had no husband, she had no children, she had no brother-in-law, which would be the next in those days. So, you know, if your husband died, then your brother-in-law would take you in and be able to provide for you, you know, if you have children, again, which she didn't have. And I think the other interesting part about it as well, as Dave touched on last time, is she was a Moabite, so she was a foreigner. So she was going to this place that she'd never been to before. She was going to this place that she didn't have any experience of. So you can imagine it's very scary sort of leaving what you're familiar with to go somewhere that, you know, you don't really know how you're going to survive. You don't really have any concrete plans in terms of what's going to happen there. And so for me, again, today, I just kind of think of that really as being a foreigner in a foreign place. Today, I guess, would be trying to be maybe a refugee, leaving your country, leaving what's familiar, and going somewhere where, you know, they're not necessarily going to welcome you with open arms. They're not necessarily going to have a plan for you. And so this is where kind of Ruth finds herself, because in her case, she was even worse, because she was an economic migrant. She was migrating in order to be able to get a better situation for herself. And it just started to kind of point out to me certain things in terms of, you know, those groups of people, right? And how they normally get treated. And I'm thinking, not, you know, a lot has changed, obviously, but maybe not a lot has changed, you know? Maybe even now, things are still quite hard for people who are migrating for economic reasons or coming in as refugees, etc. So, yeah, that's what I had going through my head. And then, if we go on to the next one, I asked myself the question, how long does the average Hollywood movie take to make? Because that's very, very relevant to what we're doing here with Ruth. So, I'm going to pose that question to you guys because I've done my research. I've Googled it. Yeah. How long, I want to get some guesses. How long do you think it takes for the average Hollywood movie to be made?
6 months.
Oh, I've got it in days, but yeah, 6 months, okay. 2 years, 3 years. I think some people might have been cheating. Looking at my notes. Has somebody else Googled this? I thought this would be harder than it is. Diana, if you go to the next one, there you go. It takes 871 days, so 2.5 years, before cinema a movie is actually released. But what was interesting was even though it takes that long from when it was announced to when it actually gets into the cinema, it's all the stuff that you have to do in order to be able to get the movie out, which again, I don't think you guys can read very well. But the interesting part is that little gray bit right in the middle there is about 100 odd days, which is about 3 months, Dave. And that's the amount of time that they actually do shooting. So prior to that, they spend a lot of time doing the promotional stuff, editing it, planning it, writing, you know, going through the script, etc. And actually it takes somewhere between a day to just shoot 2 pages of each script. So then I started thinking about this story that we're reading about Ruth, right? So we've got this story that is 23 verses in the Bible, in this particular chapter, actually it's 23 chapters. But what I was trying to think of was, obviously, this is not the whole story, right? So when you shoot a movie, you're gonna shoot for hours, you're gonna shoot for months, but movies don't last 3 months, right? Movies are, 1.5, 2 hours long. So which means that you kind of edit, right? You kind of get the most important bits and you kind of put them together to create that movie. So I started thinking, I wonder what it would have been like if we all had to watch the unedited version of these movies, right? We'd be watching for hours, right? And I think for me, it was quite important to then sort of start to say, do we really take care to look at the elements of what we have within the story? Because, you know, for the particular 23 verses that form this middle bit of Ruth's story, was put together in that way to help us to understand the story better. But I think sometimes, and I'll be
the first person to admit it. I'm very guilty of just kind of wanting to quickly get through to the end. And that's what I was talking about. So when I read a book, just kind of, where are we going? Where does this end? Do I have the next one, Diana? I'm not sure if I... There we go. I don't like plodding. I don't like going through 200 pages to find out what happened. I want to get to the end. I want to find out what happened. But in this particular story, we have to be careful not to do that. We have to be careful not to jump to the end. We would have missed out on really understanding what Ruth's plight was like, really understanding the significance and the importance of the introduction of this new character, this man Boaz, to this story, right? So Boaz is basically introduced here, and I think it was interesting to see that Boaz was also introduced as someone who, you know, helped Ruth, right? But what was interesting was Ruth had an expectation in terms of help that she was going to get, right? So she was very happy to be allowed to glean the leftovers because, you know, even that was more than what she felt she deserved. But Boaz was not like that. So Boaz would really have not lost anything because his obligation was to allow her to glean. That was what was legally required of him. But he wasn't legally required to do any more. But he did a lot more than she would have expected. And so what really stood out for me was just Boaz's generosity. He gave far beyond just dutiful giving because, of course, as I said, he did not even have a duty to give. He gave bountifully. He also gave sort of without expectation. So he didn't give to her with an expectation that he was going to get something back. And he did not give to her with that in mind at all. And so it started reminding me of other stories in the Bible, right, about people who give and the way that they give and the expectations that they have. And I just kind of think of, you know, the story that Jesus spoke about the widow and her mites, right, her two little copper coins that she put into the... Into the treasury for the temple. I think I have another picture here. If I'm not mistaken, there we go. And I don't know if you can see very well, but one of those guys. and that was what Jesus was talking about, because he was talking about, you know, the guys that put loads of money in and made a show about putting loads of money into the treasury. But the lady just quietly came in with her two little bits and just put it in there. And it started making me to think about us, right, and how we give. And I started thinking about how I give in my workplace. And, you know, for those of us who are running businesses, I'm just thinking, how do we treat those opportunities to give? Right? And I just wondered in my head, I was kind of playing it out to see if Jesus were to kind of show up in each of our workplaces and kind of do an audit of how we gave, I'm just wondering what he would find. I'm just also wondering how many Boazes he would find among us, you know. When I look at the story as it's presented, I think the two things that kind of stand out to me is obviously Ruth's faithfulness, right? She made a promise. She stuck with the promise. It was definitely not easy to stick to that promise. She even had loads of excuses to not continue with that promise. I think one of the things sometimes, as I said, is when we're thinking about our story as well, we have to remember that, you know, in our case, we kind of almost have a little bit of a peek, right, as to where our stories are going. But actually,
God is not necessarily editing in that way, right? He wants to look at the full story, right? And so when I think about Ruth's faithfulness and I think about Boaz's generosity, I just start to think to myself, if we think about our story in that same way, if we examine our story in a similar way, and I start to think, well, yes, I'm going to practice, right? We always talk about practice. You know, I love the way when you're a doctor, you run a practice, right? Hopefully they're a little bit more qualified than that. But I think the idea is that understanding that you don't just, you know, you don't get to that end. There's no end point in that. You're practicing, as in you keep doing it. And so for me, that's kind of what it brought into my mind is we need to practice faithfulness and generosity. And the good thing, I think, is because of grace that we have through Christ, we have the opportunity to practice faithfulness and generosity in our daily lives. I mean, I'm just trying to say that we need to be intentional in how we do this. I think to myself, who learns to ride a bike without falling? I don't know about you guys, but when I was learning how to ride my bike, I fell off it quite a few times. But I didn't stop, right? And I did get hurt, actually. Thankfully, my mom and dad are not here to hear this kind of stuff, but that's what you do. That's how you learn how to ride a bike properly. And in the same way, I'm wondering why we ever think we can hear of character without testing. Why do we think that that's the way it works? Are we going to be intentional in fighting this good fight? Well, I am. I'm going to be intentional in fighting this good fight. I'm going to be refined in the fire, and I'm going to present to God a refined heart, one that He can use. I think the last thing to kind of highlight in Ruth's story is actually Naomi's hope, right? Naomi left Moab with no hope, right? And, you know, it's interesting when you look at these kind of stories because, you know, sometimes I think we always sing that song, we say, you know, God is working, but we can't see it and we can't feel it. And this is kind of a very good depiction of this particular story, right? Naomi started off with no hope. She ends up in a very desperate situation. She relies on Ruth's faithfulness. And in relying on Ruth's faithfulness, God orchestrates the story to bring in this new character, this new man that comes in and offers hope and offers something different, right? As I said, Boaz didn't have to do any of this, you know? But he was able to see beyond what was right in front of him in that sense. And so I kind of want to end this whole thing in that same way and just thinking about Naomi's hope and saying that in the end, regardless of where we find ourselves in our journey right now, right? Regardless of where we find ourselves in our journey right now, we just have to remember this. The Bible says in God's time, He works all things to make them beautiful. And we are all part of actually a masterpiece. And I'm going to read out a few verses to kind of encourage us to remember that. But before I do, I kind of just always want to leave one image with us as we go, right? So, you know, there is Michelangelo's 16th chapel thing, right, that is on the wall, on the ceiling, right? And, you know, everybody knows about it, and people go and travel from miles away just to see it and all the rest of it. But I found it interesting that it was actually a mural that was painted on the ceiling or the roof. And what I find interesting is a ceiling just can't stay up by itself, right? You kind of need the walls around it to keep it up. So the beauty of the ceiling can't actually radiate anywhere if there isn't a wall to keep it up. And I think, you know, especially when you look at certain stories like, you know, the Davids and the, you know, sort of big stories like the Elijahs and stuff, sometimes we can always kind of think, oh, you know, my life's not that exciting, my life's not that interesting, I can't really see my story in there. But I'm just trying to make it clear that, you know, the Davids and this, you know, and the Moses and all those guys in the on the ceiling on the 16th chapel, they can't actually radiate anything if there wasn't a wall to hold them up. And so that's why I want to encourage us to say, it doesn't really matter where you fit in there, whether you're in the ceiling or whether you're part of the wall. One thing you always notice about a wall is like a missing brick, right? It has a very big effect on the wall. A few missing bricks and, you know, you might not have a building anymore. So it's very important that we all realize that God is orchestrating our story. And I think the other element of that is, as I said with the Hollywood movie, is, you know, you also need every single actor within the movie in order to make it a movie. So it's not only about, you know, who the main characters might be. There's all the other little characters that can, you know, have a part to play in that. So I'll encourage us by reading a few scriptures. In John 18, it says, Jesus says, I will not leave you as orphans, but I will come to you. And before long, the world will not see me anymore, but you will see me. Because I live, you also will live. On that day, you will realize that I am in my Father, and you are in me, and I am in you. And he says later on, but the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you all things and will remind you of everything I have said to you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid. So God will never give us more than we can bear. And he knows what we can bear. So in 1 Corinthians 10:13, he says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. And Paul says, we are more than conquerors. Because he says in Romans 8:37, no, in all things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. But we have this treasure of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but we are not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our bodies the death of Christ so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that this life may also be revealed in our mortal bodies. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles us, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning his shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and you will not lose heart. So let us run our race. Let us run our race. Because whether you're part of the wall, or you're on the ceiling, we're all reflecting the same glory. So let us run our race and let us tell our stories. Amen.